This is The Health Show, a presentation of National Productions.
Prostate cancer isn't easy. Not that being diagnosed with cancer is ever easy, but with prostate cancer, the treatment options literally go from all to nothing at all. And sometimes, doing nothing is the best option.
It is a strange concept, even for doctors, the idea of watching a cancer.
On today's Health Show, we'll talk to one of the authors of Invasion of the Prostate Snatchers and try to find out just how much fighting you should do against the disease. We'll also talk to a writer and naturalist and seed collector who says one of the keys to bringing back diversity and health to our diet is bringing back lost varieties of natural seeds. Dr. Nina Sachs is away this week. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Health Show. If a doctor sat down and said that you had cancer, we're pretty sure that your first reaction would be, "Get it out of me." Understandable. Yet a recent study in the New England Journal of Medicine concluded that out of the 50,000 prostate operations performed annually, more than 40,000 are unjustified. That's the reason Ralph Blum wrote the book Invasion of the Prostate Snatchers. Ralph has been living with prostate cancer for over a decade, doing nothing but monitoring the slow progress of the disease. Here to talk more about prostate cancer treatment is Ralph's co-author, Dr. Mark Schultz, a medical oncologist at Prostate Oncology Specialists in Marina del Rey, California. Dr. Schultz is also the executive director of the Prostate Cancer Research Group, a not-for-profit educational organization devoted to prostate cancer. Do you feel that specializing in it, it's all you see all day, and you get to really recognize the nuances of a disease that really we're just finding out the nuances of?
All I can say is emphatically yes. I was just talking with my partner, Dr. Lamb, the other day and thinking, because of the nuances, there's a lot of emotional, sexual, probabilistic subtleties to this whole thing. We were sitting there wondering, now, if someone isn't doing this full-time, how could you possibly balance out all these different competing factors? It really takes experience.
And let's get right to it now. One of the main, I'd say, themes of the book is that there is much too much surgery going on.
Yes, and I think it's the old, if you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail syndrome. The urologists, in other words, are the ones that run this business.
It's kind of scary, though, to get a cancer and be told, well, you know, we'll live with it for a while and see what happens.
I'll tell you, we describe 50% of our mission is talking people down from the tree, reassuring them that that our credentials are valid, and that as experts, when we tell them that in our judgment, based on their particular type of prostate cancer, their profile, that it's safe to watch it, we do our best to be believed, because it is a strange concept, even for doctors, the idea of watching a cancer. But the science is there, and people need to get educated about it.
I've spoken with doctors before and who've said that the biology of prostate cancer is pretty close to the biology of breast cancer. But the treatment, while breast cancer has got, now instead of total mastectomy, you have lumpectomy and other things, with prostate cancer, it's still an all or nothing at all when you go into treatment and surgery.
Right. You only have, because you can't go back for a second treatment with prostate because of all the sensitive surrounding structures like the bladder and the rectum. So that makes it an all or nothing thing. And these sensitive adjoining structures are often damaged during the treatment. If we had a simple treatment for prostate cancer, like freezing for skin cancers, we would simply just do it. But when you have a low malignant potential prostate cancer, there's some bad ones, but many of them are good ones, then you find that the treatment is worse than the disease.
How difficult is it to look at a prostate cancer and say, okay, this is one we got to work on today, but this one we might be able to work on a couple of years from now?
It's not difficult at all. And that's one message we've got to get out there. It's very easy to distinguish between the bad ones and the good ones, and that's part of the problem. The other part of the problem is that our imaging technology, our methodology for finding something else lurking in a corner of the prostate that was missed, in other words, it's not what we know about that we get concerned about. There's always this hanging question, is there a high-grade cancer that's hiding in a corner that we've missed? No one wants to make that mistake. And so that's where technology is moving most quickly, is trying to make sure that we're not missing something else that's worse. But what we identify, we can pretty much tell you whether it's a problem or not.
Over the past couple of years, the PSA test has kind of gotten beat up in the literature. Is the PSA test still the gold standard for trying to find, you know, just screening people?
It is. And I think the PSA test has been impugned improperly. What really needs to be questioned is doing so many needle biopsies. In the United States, every year, 1 million men get a needle biopsy of the prostate. And it's sort of like raking the bottom of the lake. You pick up old rubber boots, you pick up all kinds of things that you didn't even know were there, raising serious questions and frightening people. So I think PSA is fine. It's not a perfect test. It's a good early indicator. What men need to do is, if there's a PSA abnormality, it's time to go out and do your homework, not rush into a biopsy.
Well, what kind of homework are you talking about?
Well, they need to learn about this low-grade type of prostate cancer that's so common. If you take men dying of other causes in their 50s, 60s, and 70s and do an autopsy on their prostate, you'll find prostate cancer about as frequently as if you put a percentage sign after their age. So a 50-year-old man, you're going to find microscopic prostate cancer half the time. And a 75-year-old man, you're going to find it three-quarters of the time. So if you start sticking needles in the prostate willy-nilly, even in men that have normal PSA levels, you'll find prostate cancer all the time. If it's that common, the whole concept is, well, much of it can't be life-threatening. Otherwise, everyone would be dying of prostate cancer.
Is the needle biopsy itself a problem? Could that cause damage?
Yes. In addition to, you know, finding something you wish you didn't know about, which is probably the biggest damage, you can also have serious infections, serious bleeding, and erectile dysfunction, which is occurring, they think, in about a third of men. It's thought that the erectile dysfunction is reversible, but it's not been studied that carefully.
When you look at the PSA test, what other factors should people and their doctors take into account before they start, okay, it's time for the biopsy?
Okay, the biggest one is to get an accurate measurement of how big the prostate gland is. There's a lot of men walking around with big, chubby prostates, throwing off huge amounts of PSA, which has nothing to do with prostate cancer. It's just a matter of how big the prostate is. So an ultrasound of the prostate to find out if it's a big prostate or a little prostate can go a long ways to telling whether an elevation of PSA is something to be worried about or not.
What about infections of the prostate, say prostatitis or something similar? Can that also make the PSA test go crazy?
Absolutely. Us guys start getting low-grade infections in our prostate in our 20s. These low-grade infections, for the most part, we're unaware of them. We don't really realize they're happening. But they can cause scarring in the prostate. They can cause the PSA to go up. And it's believed that these intermittent low-grade infections over a lifetime are the cause of these prostate cancers. So it's a huge issue that has been really neglected. The thing to be aware of is that if your PSA is up, the doctor may be able to diagnose an infection, not by how you feel, not with a blood test, but by giving you some antibiotics. And if the PSA plummets back to normal, you pretty much know you had an infection causing the rise in PSA.
It's almost like an art of finding just the proper aggressiveness of treatment for the proper aggressiveness of the cancer. Is that what it comes down to?
It's very much so. And then there's an art to counseling people so that the patients can participate in where they want to take their chances. Do they want to take their chances with a biopsy right away? Or do they want to take their chances with watching a little while and then maybe doing a biopsy down the line if there's a continued unhealthy trend? Because there's so much gray in these decisions, there's no right or wrong answer. This idea, though, that everyone needs an immediate biopsy is too simplistic, and too many men are being shuffled into unnecessary aggressive surgery, which makes them impotent or incontinent. I mean, this is something us guys care about. I mean, the capacity to perform sexually, some of us, you know, that could be more important than life itself. That's an extreme statement, but guys are pretty crazy about these things. And they need a fair shake rather than being informed that this prostate cancer stuff is a death sentence. That's rarely the case. So these over-aggressive treatments are just out of proportion to the seriousness of the illness.
If you do go ahead and you do get prostate surgery, are those side effects a given? They're going to happen?
No, some men get lucky. If you're younger in your 50s or 60s and you go to a superb surgeon, you've got a 30 or 40% chance that you'll emerge unscathed, but those aren't very good odds.
How much does robotic surgery come into that? Does that help?
Not much. It is a little bit quicker recovery because the scars are smaller. With the old-time surgeries, you had a scar from your pubic bone up to your breastbone. So a giant zipper on your tummy, and it took a while to recover from that, you know, 3 or 4 weeks. So now they're using these little tiny incisions with robotic surgery, so you bounce back and can go back to work earlier. But the important things, like recovering sexual function and urinary function, are no different. So So it's a bit of a myth that the robotic surgery is some sort of a big advance. It's not. Not in the realm of what we really care about, recovering sexuality.
You are the co-author of this book. It goes kind of back and forth between doctor and patient. How did you find young Mr. Bloom?
Ralph approached me with this book. He had watched his prostate cancer for about 14 years. He calls himself a refusenik. And as it turned out, he was fortunate that he had the low-risk prostate cancer, and he's still chugging along, still has his prostate gland 20 years after diagnosis. In 2004, he went through a course of hormone treatments to shrivel up the prostate for 12 months. And he was so euphoric after he saw his PSA go to zero and his biopsy completely normalized that he came trundling into my office with a book idea. It was his idea to name it Invasion of the Prostate Snatchers, and that was his litmus test as to whether I was going to be his co-author or not. So he sprung the name on me, and since I didn't laugh or deride him, we ended up writing a book together.
And in the book, he talks a lot about alternative therapies. Are these things that you can say, all right, couldn't hurt, or are they things that people should aggressively look at?
Well, the most powerful, quote, alternative therapy that everyone has to consider is diet and exercise. When I came out of medical school, and many of my medical buddies, we all were sort of trained to minimize the impact of these things. So there's quite a body of research now showing that diet, just like with heart disease, there was a big battle 25, 30 years ago. The doctors that said you can reverse your heart disease with diet, make plaque go away, were laughed at initially. Now, of course, you're considered a fool if you live on roast beef and donuts. But back then, they didn't think it even mattered.
Well, finally, let's look ahead. I mean, this is your specialty, so you probably have a better view of the future than most people do. What do you see happening 5-10 years from now in treating prostate cancer?
Yeah, two exciting things coming. One is better and better ways to image the gland. We have these, digital mammograms for breast cancer. There's a lot of work being done with MRI to get a better picture inside the prostate. If we can see the cancers more clearly when they're small, then we're going to feel a lot more confident monitoring them over time. That's number one. Number two is at the other end of the spectrum, there's still, about 1 out of 6 men with prostate cancer have a type that is life-threatening. And there's wonderful work being done now to help take the teeth out of the bad prostate cancer. In other words, the type that can spread to the bones and kill people. There is preliminary work now showing where they can control that as well. Now, imagine how that's going to change everything. If they can really get a cure for the advanced type of prostate cancer, well, we'll just laugh at these early small prostate cancers because we know that we've got a safety net behind us. So what's changed in my 25-year career with prostate cancer is now they have the blueprints for how cancers work, and they're designing solutions. Now, it's an expensive and slow process doing research in humans, but they are on the track, like Sherlock Holmes, of really getting to the nitty-gritty of what cancer is and fixing it. So I tell my teenage children, my 20-year-old children, that they need to take darn good care of themselves because there's no chance at all that they're going to die of cancer. It'll be solved in the next 10 to 15, 20 years.
Dr. Mark Schultz is a medical oncologist at Prostate Oncology Specialist in Marina Del Rey, California, and the executive director of the Prostate Cancer Research Group. His new book, written with Ralph Blum, is called Invasion of the Prostate Snatchers. It's published by Random House. Still to come, are heirloom varieties of seeds the key to good health? We'll talk about it next on The Health Show. You can find The Health Show anytime online at healthshow.org. Search the archive and listen to whole programs you may have missed or would like to hear again. Even subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org. You can also follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow. You can start your own Health Show archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for Health Show number 1284. This is The Health Show. I'm Bob Barrett. Over the past month or so, we've run a couple of segments concentrating on genetically modified foods. These segments have generated a bit of email, both pro and con.
Okay, not vaccine or Lyme disease amounts of email, but a good bit. So what are some alternatives to genetically modified foods in a world with an exploding population? Janice Ray says it's rediscovering lost varieties of seeds. Janice Ray is an author, naturalist, and activist. She's on the faculty of Chatham University's Low Residency MFA program, and in 2007 was awarded an honorary doctorate from Unity College in Maine. Her latest book is called The Seed Underground, A Growing Revolution to Save Food. We spoke recently, and I asked her how a poet and teacher got involved with seeds.
I have been interested in growing things for a long, long time. And, you know, now I know the answer. The answer is life. All of those things have to do with the essence of life itself. I first got interested in seeds when I was a child. I gardened from the time I was 11 or 12 or so, and my grandmother gave me some very strange bean seeds. They're about an inch long, very beautiful white beans with dark eyes. She called them jack beans. And I planted them. They grew very big. The pods are a foot long, and these fat seeds throughout, and it sort of fired me up. I got fired up very young for plants and growing things. I think that we have written in our DNA an ancient history with plants. Humans for at least 12,000 years and as much as 70,000 have been domesticating, diversifying, adapting plants. So I think it's a pretty common feeling, this connection to the plant world.
In your book, you actually mourn the loss of so many varieties of different seeds. Just how much have we lost?
In 1901 and 1902, a kind of a comprehensive catalog of seed varieties available at that time was published. In 2004, two scientists at the University of Georgia decided to look at those varieties available a century ago compared to the ones available now. 94% of the varieties available in 1901 were not available in 2004, a 94% decline. Now, these are place-adapted, vintage, heirloom, locally adapted seeds. The statistics are even more startling when you think, let's break it down. So cabbages, 95% of vintage cabbages are gone, 96% of field corns. What happened is an industrialization of agriculture so that people like my grandfather who farmed a small diversified farm here in southern Georgia and grew all kinds of food crops for his family, he began to use chemical fertilizer. He began, when hybrid corn came out, to use hybrid corn seed. We saw the rise and fall of old-time diversified organic agriculture, and then the rise again in the last 50 or 60 years, and even sooner, a renaissance of agriculture that speaks to health, to nutrition, to health of the soil, to environmental health.
Those seeds are no longer being offered in catalogs. Now, are they gone for good, or are they just not being sold anymore? Say the more productive ones are being sold.
They're gone. The short answer, Bob, is they're gone. They're gone for good. Now, when the Seed Savers Exchange began in 1975, a lot of seed folklorists, we'll call them, stalked the country looking for heirloom varieties. And so many varieties thought lost have been reintroduced into the marketplace. But in general, it is a true decline. We go into a grocery store now and we can buy Granny Smith apple and Red Delicious apple. 100 years ago, there were 7,000 varieties of apples in this country, and 86% of them just gone. Now, here and there, you'll find orchards that are heirloom orchards that are keeping these varieties alive. But in general, the industrialization of ag has led us to monocultures, to standardization, and that means more and more farmers planting, decreasing diversity of seeds.
Well, you know what the comment will be. Well, food is cheap, so why is that bad?
What's bad is that we're losing a gene base. It's called genetic erosion. That's one thing that's bad. The second thing has meant a decline in human health. We know that for the sake of standardization, varieties are being bred to be more productive. But just because a variety is productive doesn't mean it's actually more nutritious. So we've made these huge changes to make food cheap with little regard to nutrition. Of Professor Dr. Donald Davis at University of Texas in Austin, in 2004, studied 43 garden crops, and he found reliable declines across the board in vitamins and minerals. A study was sort of replicated by a scientist in Britain, Great Britain, Dr. Anne Marie Mayer. And she found iron down an average of 22% in the past 50 years, calcium 19%. So let me just break it down a little bit. High levels of nitrogen in chemical fertilizers stimulate a plant to grow quickly and take up more water. That results in higher yields, faster yields, but less dry matter, which is the non-water component of food and includes the minerals and vitamins. That means that elevated levels of nitrogen in fertilizers can mean reduced levels of vitamin C, vitamin A, on and on and on. To carry it one step farther, you can say compost or manure or organic fertilizers, remineralization of soil, all that delivers more nutritional punch than chemical fertilizers. And just returning once more to say that we have to also look at the decline of nutrition in variety. I mean, varieties play also an important part in nutrition.
Does variety keep the soil healthy?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
Mm-mm. No, very little correlation there. The health of soil is going to be tied to what a farmer puts in. That would be using green manures, remineralizing soil, let's see, rotation of crops. But what is so amazing about your question is that you actually touched on the source of all health in this country, and that is the soil. The healthier a soil, the healthier the people of the place.
Tell us about the Seed Saver Exchange and who they are and what they do.
The Seed Savers Exchange is an organization headquartered in Decorah, Iowa. They have hundreds and hundreds, probably thousands of members. It began in 1975. A couple named Diane and Kent Whaley started this organization. They were taking care of Diane's grandfather, Baptist John Ott. He had immigrated to this country from Eastern Europe and had brought with him a few garden plants. One was a morning glory. They realized that when he died, and he did die, that they were the only people left to steward these seeds. These seeds would die out. So they named the morning glory Grandpa Ott's morning glory. There was a German pink tomato as well. And it was that incident that engendered in them the realization that all over this country, people are dying and we're losing seeds. So what Seed Savers Exchange did, really, was awakened in me and awakened in many, many people across the country this realization that we needed to do something.
Again, the name of Janice Ray's new book is The Seed Underground, A Growing Revolution to Save Food. You can learn more at JaniceRay.com. That's all the time we have for this week's Health Show. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at healthshow.org. You can explore the archive for any programs you might have missed or would like to hear again. You can also subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org. Want more? Then follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is letters@healthshow.org. Dr. Nina Sachs will be back with us next week. I'm Bob Barrett. Stay healthy and be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Health Show.
Dr. Nina Sachs is a practicing member of the American College of Gastroenterology. Bob Barrett is producer of The Health Show. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Health Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.